Welcome to today's deep dive. We are super glad to have you here because today's topic is just a really fascinating urban puzzle.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a wild story, honestly.
It really is. So, okay, let's just drop right into the setting. Picture this. You're walking through the Los Angeles Flower District, right? Specifically down at the corner of Agatha and South San Pedro Streets.
Right in the thick of it.
Exactly. And right there on the corner, you see this absolutely stunning, thriving, late 19th century storefront. It's got these perfect, intact bay windows, you know, a beautifully restored ornamental cornice up top.
Yeah, the iron details are just incredible.
They really are. And it's alive, right? Like, there are active businesses in there. You've got Orchid, Moon Atelier, Bee Flower. They're paying rent, selling flowers to the public every day.
Sounds like a preservation success story.
Right. But if you take a right turn and walk around the corner into the alleyway, you see the exact same building, but it is a complete nightmare.
Oh, yeah. It's grim.
I mean, we're talking a sagging, fire-damaged brick hazard. The roof is literally just patched together with blue tarps. There are weeds bursting out of a graffiti-covered chain-link fence.
Just a totally split reality.
Exactly. Half alive, half completely dead. And the reason we're looking at this specific structure today, it's known in the study as HCM 140, is because this isn't just an architectural history lesson for you to listen to.
Right. It's way more urgent than that.
Yeah. It is a real-time case study, literally updated just days ago on May 14th, 2026, and it drops us straight into this violent intersection of historic preservation, urban decay, and the just absolute desperate need for affordable housing.
Because it really asks the core question, you know, how do modern cities decide what to save, what to just bulldoze, and who actually gets to live in the neighborhood when the dust settles?
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this. So to really get why this building is such a headache, we need to know what we're looking at. What actually is HCM 140?
So HCM 140 is a cast iron commercial building, and it dates back to roughly 1885 to 1895.
Wow, so that's old for LA.
Very old for Los Angeles. And that specific typology cast iron makes it an absolute architectural unicorn in Southern California.
Wait, really? How rare are we talking?
It is one of only three known cast iron commercial buildings still standing in the entire city.
Only three?
Yeah, just three. And to understand why it's so rare, you kind of have to look at how they were built. Back in the late 19th century, builders realized, hey, carving ornate stone facades by hand is really expensive and slow.
Right. Highly skilled labor takes forever.
Exactly. So the industry pivoted to prefabricated cast iron. These massive foundries would pour liquid iron into standard reusable molds based on catalog patterns.
I was reading this in the source material, and it honestly just sounded to me like 1880s IKEA architecture.
That is actually a perfect analogy, yeah.
Because, I mean, you literally order it out of a catalog, it arrives flat-packed on a train, and then guys just bolted together on site.
Right. That is exactly how it worked. A developer could just flip through a catalog, pick out, you know, three ornamental windows, some fluted columns, and a roofline cornice. The foundry casts it, puts it on a rail car, and ships it.
Boom. Instant high-end architecture.
Right. And you just bolt it to the front of a basic brick building. It democratized these beautiful commercial facades. And on the East Coast, it exploded. Like, if you go to the Soho Cast Iron Historic District in New York today, there are over 250 of these structures left.
Oh. But LA only has three.
Yeah, because of the timeline and logistics. In the 1880s, shipping tons of raw, heavy iron all the way from East Coast foundries to California by rail was astronomically expensive.
Ah, makes sense.
And by the time Los Angeles really had its massive commercial boom a bit later, the technology had moved on. Builders were using brick, local stone, and eventually reinforced concrete.
So the fact that this thing is even standing is a miracle.
It really is.
But that brings us back to that weird split condition we talked about earlier. The irony is just wild. The street-facing San Pedro side, the IKEA cast iron mask, is thriving.
Right, because there's a financial incentive there.
Exactly. The owner has paying tenants in those front flower shops, so obviously they're going to keep that specific wall looking great.
Keep the paint fresh, keep the glass clean.
Yeah, but then the hidden back half is rotting away because there's no income back there. And this contradiction, you know, half pristine artifact, half collapsing ruin, creates this massive regulatory trap for the city.
A huge trap. Because the cast iron facade was put on the historic monument list way back in 1975.
So it's legally protected.
Yes. The owner cannot send a bulldozer to demolish it. But here is the catch. The historic designation prevents demolition, but it does absolutely nothing to prevent decay.
Wow. So they can't tear it down, but the city can't force them to fix the roof either.
Exactly. The owner has no financial incentive to sink millions into fixing a structurally failing, abandoned brick box in the alley. So the building is just legally frozen in purgatory.
Just trapped.
Yeah. And this specific scenario has become such a nightmare for city planners that they literally just had to invent a brand new bureaucratic classification for it.
Right. I saw this in the study from May 14th.
Yeah. So as of that May 2026 update, HCM 140 was officially put into what they're calling a Type 3 audit state.
And what's the actual name of that classification?
It's called Architecturally Significant TAN Failing.
Wow. They really just spelled it right out.
They had to. It applies when a building's exterior is a protected historical artifact, but the underlying structure is failing, and this is crucial, it sits on land that is facing intense redevelopment pressure.
Okay, let's talk about that land. Because the environmental reality of this specific plot is grim.
Oh, it is terrifying. The study cites the Cal Enviro Screen, which is California's tool for mapping pollution burdens. And this site is in decile 10.
Which means what exactly?
It means it sits in the 99.7 percentile for environmental burden.
Wait, 99.7%, meaning almost the entire state is cleaner than this corner.
Yes, it is one of the most heavily burdened tracts in California. The study notes there is an 87% probability of type 1 contamination in the soil right beneath this building.
And type 1 isn't just like litter. We're talking serious toxins.
Oh, yeah. We are talking heavy metals. Arsenic, lead, volatile organic compounds, because this site is just 143 meters away from the inactive Ace Plating Company.
An old industrial plating site. That's awful.
It's a notorious contamination source.
Yeah.
And it gets worse. Even the nearest school to this site, which is the Central Region 9th Street K8, is literally classified as a contaminated site dealing with arsenic and lead.
A kindergarten through 8th grade school? That is so bleak.
It's a very harsh reality.
But okay, let me push back here for a second. Yeah. If we have a building that is physically sagging, there's no roof, and it's literally soaking in a century of arsenic and lead from an old plating company nearby,
yeah,
is preserving it as is actually just a slow motion demolition by neglect?
No.
Like, if we don't allow it to be adapted or rebuilt, are we just waiting for it to poison the ground until it eventually falls over?
This raises an important question, right? Because a severely contaminated, failing historic structure seems like a prime candidate for a bulldozer. Just scrap it and clean the dirt.
Right.
But standard private developers won't touch land like this. The toxic remediation costs alone are huge. They'd rather build somewhere easier.
So why do urban planners care so much about this specific plot of toxic dirt?
Because of the human element. The unique economic engine surrounding it makes this land incredibly valuable to a very specific group of people.
The flower market workers.
Exactly. You have to zoom out and look at the LA Flower District. It's one of the largest wholesale flower markets in the U.S. You've got the Cal Flower Market, the Southern California Flower Market.
Plus the produce and fashion districts right there, too.
Right. And combined, these areas employ tens of thousands of low-wage workers, mostly Latino and Asian immigrants.
And the hours are just brutal. I mean, the study details this. These wholesale markets do not run on a 9-to-5 schedule.
No, not at all. The flower market opens at 2 a.m. on weekdays.
2 a.m. And because these workers obviously can't afford luxury downtown L.A. rents, they're commuting from places like East L.A. or the San Gabriel Valley.
Yeah, the study shows they're facing 30-to-90-minute one-way commutes.
By bus or rideshare? At 1 a.m. Imagine that. You're taking a 90-minute bus ride in the middle of the night to go do heavy physical warehouse labor.
It's punishing. And the reason they have to commute is because the immediate neighborhood, which basically borders Skid Row, has almost no purpose-built workforce housing.
They call it the missing middle, right?
Exactly. High-end condos just won't work here. Affluent buyers don't want to live next to a noisy, heavily industrial wholesale market with diesel trucks backing up at 3 a.m. It's not an amenity-rich zone for the wealthy.
So the people who work there can't afford to live there, and the people who can afford to live downtown don't want to live there.
Exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Planners are looking at this rotting 19th century facade, and they're looking at this 21st century 2 a.m. labor commute, and they're asking, how do we use one to fix the other?
Yes. They know the neighborhood desperately needs affordable workforce housing, and they know the historic building must be preserved, but cannot just be left to rot.
So the study lays out these four very specific blueprints, these alternative paths to solve the puzzle.
Right. And we can quickly dismiss the two extreme options. Alternative D is basically just stabilize the building in place, maybe make it a museum, but build zero housing.
Which completely ignores the actual human crisis right outside the doors.
Exactly. Then there's alternative A, which is a full historical rehabilitation. You save every original brick, every piece of wood.
Sounds expensive.
Incredibly expensive. Mm-hmm. Because you have to seismically retrofit a failing brick building while somehow cleaning the toxic soil underneath it without moving the building.
Right.
It would only yield about 45 to 60 housing units, and the study estimates the cost at a massive $700,000 to $900,000 per unit.
Almost $1 million a unit for low-wage workforce housing. Yeah, that math is dead on arrival.
Nobody is funding that, so that leaves the two heavyweights, alternative C and alternative B.
Okay, let's look at alternative C first.
So alternative C proposes completely detaching the historic cast iron facade from the building, relocating it to a public pedestrian space like Olvera Street or the Cowflower Mall, and then totally demolishing the old site.
So they clear the toxic dirt completely.
Yes. Clean the site and build a massive 12-story modern residential tower that yields 260 to 300 affordable units.
Okay, but wait. If we just peel the facade off a building and stick it in a shopping mall somewhere else across town, is that even preservation anymore?
Preservationists would say absolutely not.
Because it sounds like we're just turning architectural history into a theme park attraction at that point. You lose all the context.
And the study actually brings up a huge historical precedent for why that's a bad idea. The 1963 demolition of Penn Station in New York City.
Oh, right. A classic tragedy in architecture.
Yeah, when they tore it down, they saved little artifacts, stone eagles, columns, and just scattered them in museums and parking lots. It didn't preserve the heritage. It just created a graveyard of disconnected parts.
So relocating the facade is basically a last resort.
Exactly. Which brings us to the recommended path, alternative B.
The Frankenstein approach. I love this one.
It is wild. Alternative B proposes preserving 40 to 60 feet of the active west-facing cast iron facade exactly in place. You don't move it, but you completely demolish the rotting, failing brick structure behind it.
So you basically slice the face off and throw away the back.
Yeah. And once the back is cleared and remediated, you build a brand new 7 to 8 story podium and tower mixed-use building directly behind the 1885 facade.
That is so cool. So you walk through this 140-year-old ornate iron doorway, and you're suddenly inside a safe, modern, affordable apartment complex.
Exactly. And because they can build up to 8 stories in the back, it yields 150 to 180 workforce single-room occupancy units, or SROs.
And SROs are basically just like private dorm rooms, right?
Yeah, essentially. Very efficient. You get your own private secure room, but share communal kitchens and bathrooms. And these would rent at roughly $1,400 to $1,800 a month.
Which actually targets the demographic that needs it.
Right. And there is precedent for this Frankenstein model in New York's Soho district, but also right here in LA, like the Bradbury building rehab or the Sears mail order building in Boyle Heights, where they did partial facade retentions.
But actually pulling off alternative B physically and financially sounds like an absolute nightmare.
Oh, it's brutal. The study estimates the price tag for alternative B is anywhere from $67.5 million to $103 million.
That is a huge variance. Right. Why is it so wide?
Because of all the hidden dangers.
Yeah.
Just the contamination, remediation, cleaning that type 1 toxic soil to residential standards adds $5 to $10 million right off the bat.
Wow.
Yeah, they have to install full chemical vapor barriers under the foundation so the toxic fumes don't seep into the ground floor apartments.
Okay, but what about the actual physical construction? Because taking the back off a building while leaving a heavy iron mask standing sounds really delicate.
That is the other massive cost, around $5 to $9 million just for structural engineering. You have to understand, cast iron is incredibly strong under compression, meaning weight pushing down, but it is dangerously brittle under lateral tension.
Like wind or vibrations from a bulldozer.
Exactly. The second you demolish the brick backing, that heavy 1885 iron wall just becomes a giant fragile sail. It would snap.
So how do they keep it up?
They have to design and build a massive temporary steel armature, like a structural exoskeleton on the sidewalk, just to hug the facade and hold it completely still while they dig a foundation right behind it.
That is insane. So obviously, standard private developers are not going to fund a $100 million Frankenstein project with an 8-story exoskeleton just to rent affordable SROs.
You know, standard developers want a return in like 3 years. This project requires what the industry calls patient capital.
Patient capital. meaning people willing to wait a long time.
Decades, sometimes. The public funding stack would rely heavily on 9% and 4% historic tax credits, which you only get if you keep the facade in place.
But tax credits alone aren't going to build this.
Right. And that's where the study introduces this brilliant master lease concept. They recommend bringing in the actual labor unions whose members are doing the 2 a.m. commutes.
Oh, like UFCW Local 770.
Exactly. Or SEIU-USWW. The union would step in as an anchor sponsor and master lease 30 to 50 of those SRO units for, say, a decade.
So they guarantee the rent.
Yes. They guarantee the rent for their workers. Then you take that guaranteed union contract to a CDFI.
A community development financial institution.
Right. Not a regular bank, but a lender specifically designed to finance complex community-focused projects. The CDFI sees the guaranteed union leases, they see the tax credits, and they provide the massive construction loan.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is just kind of beautiful.
Yeah.
You're taking this historic artifact that was built to house 19th century wholesale goods, and you're engineering it to house 21st century wholesale workers.
It really is, but the study is very clear. You cannot just walk into the city planner's office tomorrow and say, let's do this.
Right. There are massive unknown variables.
Yeah. The most urgent recommendation in the entire study is that they need to spend $150,000 to $300,000 immediately to run three vital diagnostic reports.
Okay. What are they?
A phase two environmental assessment to map the toxins, a structural engineering report, and a metallurgical conservation assessment.
That last one, the metallurgy test. That is so critical. I mean, it's basically a pre-op medical workup before a major surgery.
That's a great way to look at it.
Like, you can't just slice the back off a building without checking its bone density and its blood work first.
Yeah.
They have to see if that 140-year-old iron can actually survive being bolted to a new steel skeleton.
Exactly, because if the iron is too degraded, it will just shatter. And if the iron fails, alternative B fails, and we are right back to ripping the facade down and sticking it in a mall.
Wow. We have covered so much ground today. I mean, from discovering this rare 1880s cast iron unicorn hiding behind flower shops to the nightmare of the bureaucratic Type 3 audit state.
The toxic soil, the 2 a.m. commutes.
Oh, yeah, the brutal reality for those thousands of workers. And finally, this inspiring, albeit incredibly grueling, vision of Alternative B, a seven-story housing complex rising behind a 140-year-old facade, completely funded by patient capital and union leases. So what does this all mean?
I think it means that cities are living ecosystems. You know, they are not static museums. Preserving the past is important, but it shouldn't come at the expense of ignoring the actual pressing human needs of the present.
Right.
Alternative B shows that a compromise is possible. It's wildly difficult, but it's possible.
Yeah. And that brings me to this final thought, because Alternative B literally saves the face of the building while replacing its entire body to serve a modern purpose. But it makes you wonder, if a city preserves only the street-facing masks of its historic architecture while entirely replacing what happens inside, are we actually preserving history? Or are we just designing a very beautiful stage set for modern life? Next time you walk past a historic storefront, ask yourself, how much of the past is really still standing behind that glass? Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.